Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. In this interview, John Kish tells us about the history of black cinema and the separate cinema archive. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, and today I've got great pleasure to be able to speak to John Kish, who's the creator of Separate Cinema, which is the largest collection of Afro-American cinematic art in the world. John, it's very nice to have you here today.
Well, thanks, Hugh. I appreciate it. Thanks for asking.
We're going to talk about Separate Cinema and your interest in cinema, black cinema in particular. You haven't always had an interest in black cinema, but can you remember a moment at the beginning when you really felt drawn to the subject?
That would probably be when I was in college in the early 70s at Bard, upstate New York. I had always had an interest in rhythm and blues and sax playing by Louis Jordan in particular, and his band, the Timpani Five. And by chance, a friend of mine in Austin, Texas, gave me a poster. And he thought I would really like it from my dorm room wall. It was an image of Louis Jordan in a short film he did in 1945 called Caledonia.
I remember that.
And it was just the nicest thing I could put on my wall. Everybody loved it. And it was very welcoming kind of imagery for me in art school. I mean, I love the graphics, I love the music connotations, and it found a perfect home on my wall.
Mama didn't know what Caledonia was putting down. So I'm going down to Caledonia's house and ask her just one more time. Caledonia! Caledonia! What make your big head so hot?
So you got Caledonia by Louis Jordan on your wall. What happened next?
Well, I eventually graduated from school and became a commercial photographer and was on the road frequently with musical acts and just traveling for clients. And during the day, I would find myself looking for more graphic artwork pertaining to music. Duke Ellington, Nat King Cole, more Louis Armstrong, Louis Jordan, anything. And I found a place down in Memphis, Tennessee, close, right around the corner from the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was shot.
Right.
And I went in there one day and I got to know the owner for a few minutes and I said, can I ask you to close the shop for a couple of hours so I can go through what you have here for sale, and I'll take care of you. I'll pay good money for it.
Yeah.
And he did. And at the end of the day, I ended up walking out with an armful of black-related music, specifically posters that I took back to my photo studio and ended up putting on the walls and, you know, just trying to make my collection a little bit larger.
Yeah.
It was very exciting to find these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And being in Memphis, it was the perfect kind of town.
Perfect location for
finding,
for
yeah,
it.
Perfect, yeah. Finding that stuff.
Yeah.
So one day I had a serendipitous meeting, which changed my life, when sportscaster Ahmad Rashad came up to my studio to see some of the posters that he'd heard about that I had on my walls. You know, he pointed to one poster in particular, Emperor Jones, which starred the great singer Paul Robeson. And he said to me, he asked me if I knew about Paul Robeson and what he meant to Black America, what he did in America, and what he did abroad. And honestly, I didn't. And I told him that. And he shook his finger at me and he said, you know, Kish, you got to learn some history here.
Yeah.
And he was so right. And I did. And I never forgot Ahmad's visit. And it really turned my head around about Black film history.
So tell me a bit about Robeson.
Well, Robeson was America's finest and maybe best known Black singer of the 20s and 30s. He had a baritone voice that was as deep as a well, and his songs, such as his trademark Old Man River,
right,
made him one of the most popular concert singers of all time, both here and abroad. Throughout those eras, Robeson was one of the first Black men to perform serious roles on Broadway and starred in a dozen or so films. Again, both here in America and some in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Among them, that was Emperor Jones, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. Song of Freedom, Showboat, The Proud Valley. He was renowned and very well loved internationally, performing benefits everywhere throughout the world.
And stuff for civil rights, sort of.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
He would perform for causes of social justice.
Mm.
And he was, in fact, a national leader in the war against fascism abroad and racism here in America.
There's an old man called Mississippi. That's the old man that I'd like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? That old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton. And damn that planter, it's soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and wrecked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that veil, get a little drunk, and your land's in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying, but Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along. Let me go away from the Mississippi. Let me go away from the white man boss. Show me that stream called the River Jordan. That's the old stream that I long to cross.
Old Man River, that Old Man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling.
Body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge and lift that bale. We gets a little drunk and we lands in jail.
I get weary and sick of crying. I'm tired of living and scared.
So, John, I always ask this question to people I'm interviewing. Can you remember the first film you ever saw in a cinema?
Absolutely. It was in 1961 when I was 7 years old. My grandfather took me to see Kubrick's biographical Roman slave drama, Spartacus, with Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
Woody Strode, who played a sympathetic gladiator matched against Kirk Douglas, was the first black actor I remember ever seeing on screen.
Huh, and in your first film at the cinema, amazing.
Yeah. However, you know, by the time I turned 13 in 1967, I became more aware of film in general. And certainly I wasn't going to the theater anymore with my grandfather.
No.
I was there with my friends, and my school friends instead.
Yeah.
But films like that that caught our eyes were Bonnie and Clyde, Cool Hand Luke, The Dirty Dozen, that kind of thing. Mm. But the one film that I remember most, it was To Sir With Love.
Mm.
It was most memorable because of the soundtrack, which was all over the airwaves. It was by the British singer Lulu.
She got a number one in America with it, I think.
And, you know, the thing about the British invasion of music was in full force in 1967.
Yeah.
So that, coupled with Sidney Poitier as a school teacher that we all wish we had, really spoke to me.
Mm.
You know, plus Judy Geeson, she was kind of hot.
Yeah.
Anyway, the title song, yes, as you mentioned, went to number one. And it won a Grammy and probably Billboard magazine's number one single of the year, I'm sure.
If you wanted the sky, I would ride a I know that I am leaving my best friend, a friend who taught me right from wrong and weak from strong.
Of course, Sidney Poitier had his best year in 1967 with two leading roles in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which was an Academy Award-winning film by Stanley Kramer, of course. Yeah. And it shed an early light on interracial marriage.
Yeah.
And also In the Heat of the Night.
With Rod Steiger.
That's right. An Oscar winner with Poitier as a black detective investigating a murder in a small southern town.
Run by Steiger.
A white racist.
Yeah,
Chief of police, Ron
Steiger. And Sterling Siliphant got an Oscar for the screenplay,
That's right. And Quincy Jones composed the soundtrack with a title song performed by Ray Charles.
Brilliant.
Accompanied in the background with an organ played by a very young Billy Preston. That is incredible soundtrack.
In the heat night. Seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah, in the heat of night, I'm feeling motherless somehow. The skies, all mean and bright.
In the heat of the night,
ain't a woman yet been born.
Ooh.
Knows how to make the morn. Sell my soul for just a little light
in the heat of the night.
In the heat of the night, I've got trouble wall to wall. Oh yes, I have. In the night, must be an ending to it all. But hold on, it won't be long. Just you be strong, and it'll be all right. In the heat of the night.
So your creation, Separate Cinema, it's become the largest collection in the world. And how did it begin?
Well, the name Separate Cinema refers to the race films, that's what they were called, that proliferated in the first half of the 20th century. They were films with an all-black cast made specifically for black audiences.
In segregated cinemas, right?
Well, they were produced outside of the mainstream Hollywood system, and they were, in effect, a parallel industry of black films that screened in, yes, segregated theaters across the country.
Mm.
They portrayed in the ideal world in which blacks were affluent, educated, and cultured, and represented a radical departure from the normal Hollywood stereotype that portrayed African Americans as jesters, servants, coons, mammies, etc. Though the separate cinema archive began in the early 70s, I continued to collect as the years went by. In the early 80s, a popular Greenwich Village restaurant named Mary Lou's, you've heard of that, asked me if we could exhibit some posters on their walls. Of course, I said yes. Yeah. That led to a review in the New York Times,
right,
and then a feature story about my collection in a magazine called Film Comment.
Mm-hmm.
And then Malcolm Forbes, who was a regular at the restaurant, he offered us an exhibit at his own Forbes magazine gallery.
Oh, where was that? Where's that located?
On Fifth Avenue, and was at 13th Street or something.
Yeah.
And things just kind of snowballed from there, culminating with a book in 1992, my first book, Separate Cinema, 50 Years of Black Cast Posters, which was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Yeah.
Once the 90s began, Separate Cinema began to offer kind of a various themed traveling exhibits to museums, both in America and abroad. And I think you might have come to one of ours in London at the British Film Institute many years ago.
Yeah, I did.
That program continued for about 25 years until pretty recently.
Yeah. Okay, so next on your list of film music to play is Stormy Weather, sung by Lena Horne. So talk us through this one.
In 1927, Warner Brothers presented The Jazz Singer, which was the first talkie. They introduced the first talking picture.
Mm. Ever?
Yes, ever, to American movie audiences. That starred the popular American white singer, Al Jolson, who appears in the final scene in blackface, singing My Mammy.
Mm.
Well, that brought huge profits to Hollywood studios.
Mm.
And they decided to kind of look at black plantation life as a possible musical showcase.
A commercial proposition.
Yes, for spirituals, minstrel comedies, because authentic black singing voices were so bold and robust, they were perfect for the new sound technology.
Got it.
2 years later, in 1929, Hearts and Dixie became the first all-black cast, all-talking musical that came out of Hollywood to reach the screen.
Wow.
That film began a 30-year cycle of black cast musicals, which included Hallelujah, Green Pastures, Cabin in the Sky, Carmen Jones, Porgy and Bess, and my favorite, Stormy Weather, which in 1943 provided the perfect professional signature for singer Lena Horne's career.
Lord above will let me walk. together. Keeps raining all the time. Keeps raining all the time. I walk around heavy-hearted and sad. Night comes around and I'm still feeling bad. Rain pouring down, blinding every hope I had. This pittering, pattering, beeping and scattering drives me mad. Love, 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 love. This misery is just too much.
Now, John, this is a tough one. If there's one film in black cinema you would recommend, what would it be?
Oh, that's very tough indeed. Only because the black film's journey has been so long. Mm. And with important films every step of the way, absolutely.
I know, it's difficult.
It'd be impossible to recommend only one. However, my personal favorite, and you probably know this already, is No Way Out.
Oh, yeah.
Joseph Mankiewicz's 1950 drama that actually launched Sidney Poitier's career, where he played a county hospital doctor tending to a white racist patient played by Richard Widmark.
Yeah,
fantastic
right.
film.
Yeah.
This film, more than any other, captured the mood of the post-war America and summed up its repressed racial hostilities at that time.
Yeah.
Ellington, by the way, provided the jazz soundtrack with, I think, Don't Get Around Much Anymore,
yeah.
Sophisticated Lady, and In a Sentimental Mood.
Okay, you're probably expecting this one. Tell me about blaxploitation.
That's, blaxploitation, early 70s, it's a term that was coined. It refers to black action films that were produced for or aimed at black audiences.
Right.
They featured African-American actors in the lead role, and they provided the black audiences with cinematic heroes and a portrayal of urban life that was unseen in Hollywood pictures at that time.
Got it.
Director Melvin Van Peebles in 1971 produced independently a film called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. That's probably credited with kicking off the genre of blaxploitation, but it wasn't until MGM's release of Shaft a few months later, coincidentally, that probably set a more precise blueprint for all of the movies that would follow.
Do you think there was a sort of, can I just ask something? Do you think there was a sort of a race between those two, getting who's going to be first getting that a film out? Tapped into that.
Well, no, because
they didn't know about each other.
Van Peebles was doing this on the side, independently.
Oh, I see.
And he certainly wouldn't have been.
No.
He might have known about.
Yeah.
Of course, he would have known about Shaft.
The production, yeah. But they might not have heard about him.
But they, well, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, the Shaft was done a couple of months later, and it was directed by Gordon Parks. It starred Richard Roundtree. And the film's success came just as Hollywood was realizing, because of these films, the power of the black ticket-buying audience.
Mm.
Shaft, by the way, won an Academy Award for Best Original Score.
Yeah, by Isaac Hayes.
With the theme song written and recorded by the Stax Records. Great, Isaac Hayes.
And I think I read that Isaac Hayes actually went up for the part, Richard Roundtree's part.
Yes, he did.
Auditioned.
He did.
And he didn't get it, so they said, well, write us a song instead.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good thinking.
Yeah, good consolation prize. We'll be right back.
ride a dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks. You're damn right. The man that would risk his neck for his brother, man. Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. You see, this cat Chef is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Chef?
Well, we can do it.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Shaq.
By 1976, regardless of the popularity of the films, the actors like Roundtree, Ron O'Neill, Pam Grier, Fred Williamson, Jim Brown, audiences started to tire of the endless reworking of the crime action ghetto formula.
Oh, there were stereotypes again.
There were stereotypes, yeah. Critics began to see the films as morally bankrupt. Stereotypical, of course, and portraying black actors in a most negative way. Within a year, at least, films ceased being made.
So with blaxploitation over, it did serve a purpose, though, didn't it, of opening new doors?
Yeah, though it took a few years. You know, films like Coolie High, Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars, Car Wash, Thank God It's Friday, along with the emergence of films with comedians like Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor in the early 80s, that all helped with the assimilation of black culture into the conventional Hollywood movie, like A Soldier's Story or The Color Purple or Around Midnight, whose soundtrack, by the way, is won Herbie Hancock an Oscar for the best score.
Mm-hmm.
Then arrived director Spike Lee.
Right.
With his He Too, an independently made film, She's Gotta Have It, 1986, that was shot in his own Brooklyn neighborhood with a cast of his own friends for only $175,000, which is nothing in the film world in 1980, in the 80s.
Yeah.
He single-handedly demonstrated to Hollywood the potential of independent black film that can make money and can that black audiences, as well as white, would support.
Mm.
Since then, a number of black actors and directors, among them Denzel Washington, Sam Jackson, Angela Bassett, Halle Berry, Robert Townsend, Bill Duke, and the late John Singleton.
Yeah.
They've succeeded in establishing themselves as big office draws. Huge, in fact.
Yeah. So do you think black cinema is underappreciated these days?
Well, black film is certainly appreciated more these days in light of historic recognition.
Yeah.
However, the journey of black film from those early days in Hollywood, when blacks were only given subservient roles, compared to the environment today where black actors, writers, and directors are winning Academy Awards, certainly illustrates just how far everyone has come, including the audiences.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the most recent black cinema release that you've seen that's impressed you?
Specifically, the most recent films by Barry Jenkins, Ryan Coogler, Ava DuVernay, Lee Daniels are prominent, of course. However, the most recent film I've seen that I was impressed by is Harriet, the Casey Lemons biodrama starring Cynthia Erivo in the role of Harriet Tubman, the runaway slave, you know, turned abolitionist during the years around the Civil War.
Yeah, based on true story.
It's funny that you bring this up, because when I began this interview, we started talking about what first impressed me as a child.
Right.
And that was 1960s Spartacus.
Spartacus, yeah.
And I end up here talking about Harriet, which 60 years later, in 2020, Hollywood is still selling us the story of slavery.
Yeah.
Historic, yes, and audiences still love to take the side of the underdog.
Mm. Interesting.
Harriet, by the way, received two Oscar nominations, one for Erivo for Best Actress and Best Original Score.
So, John, what's happening to separate cinema?
Well, since 2015, I wrote another book published by Real Art Press called Separate Cinema, The First 100 Years of Black Poster Art. I had the help of Henry Louis Gates, who wrote the foreword, and Spike Lee, who contributed the afterword.
Right.
And the book kind of highlights the posters of the Separate Cinema Archive from the perspective of their innovative poster design. And
Which drew you to the Caledonia poster in the first place.
Absolutely. And it includes foreign posters and American posters and a lot of writing about the eras, the styles. And, you know, it's a 300 and somewhat page book. So there's a lot of material.
One.
Yeah. And we're very proud of it. This past summer, however, in 2019, George Lucas and his wife, Melody Hobson, acquired my archive. And they want it permanently housed at their new Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, which is currently under construction in Los Angeles.
Well, that's great. And when can we expect to see the archive on public display?
Well, they say that the museum will open in 2021, and they've promised me that the separate cinema archive will be available for educational research, as well as featured in ongoing different kinds of exhibits.
Exhibits, as the...
You know, this is in addition to the Star Wars stuff, of course, and the art collection that both George and his wife Melody have, including Norman Rockwell material and all kinds of things. It's going to be very interesting.
Great.
I'm honored to be a part of it.
That's great. Great news. Thank you for sparing the time to speak with me today. And when the museum opens, the world at large will be able to see the separate cinema archive. We look forward to it.
Thanks to you. I appreciate it. Always good talking about this stuff. Maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Take the pain away. for so long.